ones that are going to show up most frequently on an examination. Page number 119, your syllabus. Some printed material that I'm not going to take time to go over in class has to do with how do we know about these dates. Most people open their Bible, they see a date there in the margin, and they never stop to ask themselves, how did the scholars come up with these dates? After all, they weren't using our system of measuring time back there in the Old Testament days, were they? So somebody had to find the way of computing how their time system fits into our time system. And I explained that on page 119 of the syllabus. It has to do, basically, to get to the bottom line, it has to do with the fact of the eclipses of the sun that were noted in ancient records. And by means of astronomy, scientists can establish the exact date when an eclipse of the sun would have been visible at a given spot on the earth. That gives you some fixed points in history. Working from those fixed points, we then examine the Bible and the ancient records of Assyria and Babylonia and Egypt, get the length of the reign of various kings and whatnot. We work our way from those fixed points backward and forward to establish the chronology that we know about from the Old Testament. It sounds complicated. It really isn't all that complicated. And back to about the time of David and Solomon, there really isn't a great deal of disagreement about dates. There's pretty much uniformity. Now, you get back beyond David into what we've been going over before, you'll find a wide variety of opinions. Some of it comes about because some scholars do not take seriously the materials in the Scripture that God has given to us to help us to establish the flow of time. All right, let's come to our events for today. 1 Samuel chapter 8. And we're talking about the request of these elders who came to Samuel with a request that they have a king. Why did they come to Samuel? What does it start out here in chapter 8? Now, it came about when Samuel was old, he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Mistake. Bad mistake. Why was that a mistake? Was that the reason it was a mistake? Mark.
It says that Samuel appointed them, not God.
All right. So, what are you driving at?
Well,
make it plain.
They weren't in the realm, they would have been important to God.
Why did Samuel appoint his sons as judges in the land? Let me come at it from that standpoint.
Yes.
All right, now that's the point I'm trying to lead you to see. Most parents are totally blind when it comes to their own children. It's very rare that you have parents that can correctly assess the capabilities of their own children. Most parents are either pushing their children too hard. Some of you, if this was a psychology class, we could probably have a survey in here, and I would conclude that a number of you have been under the frustration all of your life. You've never been able to live up to the expectations of your parents, or at least you feel that you haven't been able to. And I suppose nothing comes up in my office more when kids come in for counseling than that very thing. I just cannot measure up. They expect so much of me, I cannot do it, and this, that, and the other. And they think I'm something I'm not, or they're trying to make me something I don't want to be. So parents many times are trying to live the life of their children. Some of you are here in Bible college in opposition to what your parents have expressed for you. And that's a real hardship and frustration for you. And you have to understand that many parents, even Christian parents, measure things by materialistic standards. And they're concerned about you being able to support yourself and this, that, and the other as time goes on. And they don't really understand the values of a Bible college education. They don't really put the premium on spiritual growth and development. And I think most of you realize what is happening to you as you look at your life in Bible college. You see yourself learning the Word, learning to appreciate things of the Spirit, growing. And you understand the values of this type of education. Well, I think Samuel made a double mistake here. Number one, it's called nepotism when you try to put your own family into positions of leadership, pad the payrolls with your own members of your own family and close cronies. think Samuel was wrong on that in that respect. Even if his sons had been of sterling character, I don't think that would have been a wise thing to do. Just don't put your family into positions of leadership when you have the power to do so. If other people put them into those positions, that's a different proposition. But when you take your misuse your position by trying to get your family involved, that is bad. Now, of course, his sons were rotten. And they were judging down in the southern part of Judea in the place called Beersheba, according to verse 2. Now, verse 3, his sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. What other godly man have we recently studied about who had problems with his two sons? Yeah. Whose names were Ophni and Phinehas. Now here, Joel and Abijah. Same problem. Two godly men, failures as fathers. Or is that a fair statement? Is it fair to always judge a parent by the way his children turn out? I don't think it is always fair. I tell you, parents live under a great burden sometimes. And I remember reading the other day Guideposts. You know, that's a nice little devotional magazine. Good for, really does me a lot of good to read it from time to time. And a story of a mother who really raised her children in the church, and in a home, was a model home, as everything she could do in terms of teaching them the right way. She gets a telephone call one night. The son had been in an automobile accident and drunken driving. He was at the point of death in the hospital in the middle of the night. She, of course, called her preacher immediately. He came over and went to the hospital with her. And as they rode in the ambulance, the preacher was reporting this. He said, I tried to think of something I could say to comfort this mother. I was trying to think what she must be thinking, blaming herself, hanging a guilt trip on herself because she perceived herself to be a total failure in spite of all that she had done. Finally, he thought of a passage in the Old Testament where God is talking about how Israel had gone astray. And God says, in effect, what more could I have done? And he opened his Bible and pointed that verse out to him. What more could I have done? You know, you do all that you could possibly do. And the final analysis, every individual eventually makes his own or her own choice as to whether they're going to live for the Lord or live a godless, rebellious life. Everybody has to make that decision. And it's not always fair. Blame the parents because the children turn out like we see these children. And yet, it is strange that here in the same historical context, we have two men side by side, Eli and Samuel, both of them godly men, lovely characters, whose two sons, in both cases, turned out to be rotten eggs. And that's really hard to explain. It ought to cause us all to take a warning. One would have thought that Samuel, growing up there in the tabernacle, would have observed what happened to Eli's family and would have taken extra cautions. Yes, man.
It's raised by Eli.
That's true.
He didn't have a good role model in the first place.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. And sometimes you see a kid that grows up in an alcoholic home. Are they going to become an alcoholic, or are they going to turn utterly and totally against alcohol? I've seen it work both ways. I've seen it go both ways. It gets down to personal decision, personal choice. Dan reminds us that Samuel did not have a good role model, but he did know by divine revelation that Eli had been far too lenient with these boys. He knew that. God had said that. Eli loved those boys more than he loved the Lord, the Bible said. Put them before the Lord. And so Samuel knew that. Well, in any case, we could talk about that for a long time, but we need to move on and get our facts here about this episode. They came and asked for the king. King, verse 6, it displeased Samuel. He is a great man of prayer. He prays about it. Samuel is regarded in the Old Testament as one of the three great men of prayer. Moses, Abraham, and Samuel are the three biggies. Now, you could add to that list other big men of prayer, like Elijah, for example. But in the Old Testament, those three are usually grouped together as men of great men of prayer. And so here he goes to God in prayer. And God says in verse 7, now this is important that we understand what we're reading here. Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you. See, Samuel apparently was taking this personally. They have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Now, the government of Israel was a theocracy. Theocracy. God was king. And now they're coming and wanting a human monarch or ruler. And God said, don't be upset at this, Samuel. It's nothing personal. They're rejecting me. I'm the one that ought to be upset in this whole situation. He goes on in verse 8 to say, this is just another example of a continuing line of examples of where people, these people, the people of Israel, have been rebellious against my will. Now he says, go to them in verse 9. Warn them what a king is going to be like. Spell it out for them. Paint a picture for them. And then if they go ahead and want a king, okay. But at least we'll go into this thing knowing what it's going to involve. Well, the people, after Samuel spells out to them what the king is going to be like, he says he's going to take your sons and put them in his army. He's going to take your daughters and put them in his kitchens. And for various other purposes, he's going to take a tithe of your crops. That's interesting, isn't it? The king would take a tithe of their crops. Now that perhaps helps us to explain the origin of tithing as a common way of rendering tribute to a king. And since God was king, he deserved the tithe according to the law of Moses. Now along comes Samuel and says, if you put yourself up a king, you expect to give another tithe because he'll take a tenth of your income. Our government is generous. They just take 20% of our income, twice as much as the ancient kings did. But anyway, so Samuel prays again, and the Lord tells him to go ahead now and anoint a king for Israel. We want to stop and analyze again the reasons why the people requested a king. Let's notice at least five reasons why the people requested a king. First of all, we've noted already in our study that there was a long-standing desire for a king in Israel. Can anybody document that statement from our recent study together? Duane. Who can document that? Mr. Mark. Yes, I wasn't thinking so much of that as a concrete illustration long before Hannah's time. Yes. Well, I'm thinking even before that. They came to one of the judges after a great victory and offered to make him a king. Which judge was that?
Gideon.
And he turned them down. But that's the point I'm trying to make is that they desired a king. Going clear back at least to the time of Gideon. Abimelech actually succeeded in wearing the title king for a period of time. Gideon's son Abimelech over a limited portion of the country. In fact, if somebody ever asked you a question, who was the first king in Israel? Of course, that's a trick question because actually the first one to wear that title was Abimelech, wasn't it? Even though he was king over only a very small piece of real estate. Now, another point here comes out in verse 5. They wanted a king like all the other nations. I call this the be-likers. Want to be like everybody else.
Everybody's doing it. Everybody has a king. We want a king.
And of course, that's been the downfall of God's people in a lot of other areas too, hasn't it? We look over the denominational world, we see something going on there, and we go, well, we want to be like them. We want to have that. Why can't we do that? I had one lady come to me one time. She said she just had a baby born. She said she wanted me to sprinkle her baby. She said, christen her baby. And I said to her, well, what in the world would you want me to christen your baby for? She said, well, I was at a Methodist church the other day, and it was so beautiful. I saw this done. I just thought it was so beautiful. I just thought I wanted it done to my baby. Now, I don't know how you would have responded in a situation like that. And I said, well, you know, we always try to do things according to the Scripture here at the church. I said, what Scripture would you use to suggest that that's an appropriate ceremony? She said, well, didn't Hannah bring Samuel and give him dedicated to the Lord? I said, yes, that's true. I said, now, if you want to do like Hannah did and dedicate your boy to the Lord, you bring him up here, he's about 3 years old, under church raising, and you come up and see him once a year and bring and carry through on Hannah's method here, then I think that would be a very appropriate thing to do. Well, she changed her mind right quick then. Sometimes the worst thing you can do is just come down hard and say to somebody, well, you stupid ignoramus, why do you suggest such a ignoramus thing like that for? Sometimes you just have to kind of go along with it and lead them up to a point where they see it for themselves, you know, how stupid it is, and then back off. And then you still have a friend. You come down and say, well, you can't do that. Then you've made an enemy and you have accomplished. All right, anyway. Now, verse number 20 of chapter 8 indicates they wanted a leader in battle. Apparently the judges, some of them were military leaders, but apparently Samuel was not particularly a military leader, and some of the later judges were not military leaders. And they're feeling the pressure. What particular nationality is bringing pressure against them at this point? The Philistines are the big problems here. And then, of course, verse 2 brings out the thought that Samuel was old, his sons were disobedient. We've talked about that. And then a fifth point here, the desire for an uninterrupted judgeship. And so the judges were raised up periodically. They were raised up over limited portions of the country. There were interruptions. After a particular judge would die, there'd be a long period of time they'd have no national leader at all, apparently. And so these are at least five reasons. Perhaps we could add to the list, I don't know. But then we raise the question here, was the desire for a king sinful in and of itself, or was it premature? Now, of course, to be premature could make it sinful. So you understand the difference here. What I'm asking, was the desire for a king sinful in and of itself? God says they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And some people jump to the conclusion immediately, they had no business asking for a king. But when you go back into the history we've already studied, three places in Genesis, get the chapters down, you'll have to get the verses, Genesis 17, 35, and 36. Genesis 17, 35, and 36 was the promise to Abraham that he would have kings among his descendants. That was a promise. So God has to fulfill his promises. In chapter 49, verse 10, a prediction of the rise of a king. 49, 10 of Genesis. Numbers 23, 24, also prediction of a king to arise in Israel. Deuteronomy 17, regulations concerning a future king when they would have one. And the most recent example was 1 Samuel 2:10, Hannah's song, which ended up with this expectation of God's king. So I am really hard-pressed to follow this traditional Sunday school explanation that it was wrong for them to ask for a king at all, period. I don't think it was wrong for them to have a king. I think what was wrong was they didn't wait for God to initiate it. You see the point? They took it up in their own self. Yeah. And that's another situation. We'll be getting to that in a minute. The kind of king they wanted, or a king like all the other nations. But all I want to just nail this down, because it's such a common idea. I expect most all of you heard this idea. Well, God didn't intend for them to have a king. I just can't buy that. I think God was waiting for David. And these people jumped the gun. You jumped the gun with the Lord. I think it's wrong. I'm not saying it wasn't sinful. Anytime you jump the gun on the Lord, it's sinful. It's wrong. But it wasn't wrong for them to have a king. It was just wrong for them not to trust God to provide them with a king. Okay, so I want to nail that down. Now then, we come in chapter 9 here to the selection process of this first king of Israel. And it's a rather interesting story here about Saul. He lost some livestock. His father had lost some livestock. Saul was of what tribe? What has happened to the tribe of Benjamin since we started our study this quarter?
Yeah.
It was nearly wiped out. So it was always one of the smallest tribes. And now, in more or less recent history, they had almost been wiped out. So Saul comes from one of the, just a very small minority within the nation. He was the son of Kish, and they had lost their donkeys. And so Saul was sent out to look for the donkeys. And we trace from Saul's home at Gibeah. Gibeah. Anybody remember what happened at Gibeah? Yeah, that was a terrible episode that happened in Gibeah. Well, that was Saul's hometown. And you can trace on the map then his tour looking for those donkeys. A three-day tour. The map makes it look perhaps a lot larger than it really was. But he searches for these his father's donkeys all through the area there of Ephraim and doesn't find them. And they're coming near to Ramah. And the servant suggested, or was it Saul? Saul seduced it. Saul suggested that they go to the prophet, and I never could remember who said. I don't remember the details. The servant suggested it, Lisa.
Saul wanted to go along.
Let's get this straight, Lisa. You got me all confused. Now, who was it that suggested they go to the prophet? What difference does it make? One or the other of them suggested that they go to the prophet. And whichever one didn't suggest it, say it. This is important, I think. The one who didn't suggest that they go to the prophet, say it. Why couldn't they go to the prophet? Didn't have any money. What does that suggest was the custom of the day? When somebody went to make use of the services of the prophet, they took them a gift. Now, there was no provision in the law of Moses for the maintenance of prophets. There was provision in the law of Moses for the maintenance of priests. Apparently, prophets like Samuel lived on the freewill offerings of people who loved them and trusted them and made use of their prophetic insight. So I thought that was interesting that it mentions here. And one of them said, well, I have a little bit of money. Let's go. Let's go consult with the prophet. So when they come to Ramah, sure enough, Samuel is having a sacrifice in Ramah today. But wait a minute. Hold it. What is he doing having a sacrifice at Ramah? I thought the only sacrifice was to be conducted at the altar of the tabernacle. Dang. So, what does Deuteronomy say about altars? There's to be one altar. Maybe they moved. Come on, think, people. Think. I'm disappointed.
There was one already there.
No, he built it, according to chapter 7, verse 17. He built an altar to the Lord at Ramah. That was his hometown. But my question is, why? Shiloh has been destroyed. The tabernacle is gone. The ark is in Kiriath-Jearim. No tabernacle anymore, folks. It's gone. The Philistines destroyed Shiloh. Archaeology has confirmed that. Jeremiah makes reference to it. The ark of the tabernacle of the Lord was destroyed in this period of time. So there was no altar except this one built by Samuel at Ramah. Yeah. Well, I give you a chart in your syllabus. That's rather complex history. I'd have to go back and look at it. I've figured it all out several different times. They actually overlap a little bit. Samuel's ministry and Samson's ministry do overlap a little bit. And so they're both concerned with the Philistine problem. But now we're at the end of Samuel's career. Again, I'd have to, somewhere in your syllabus, I've given you some charts and diagrams and things that spell that sort of detail out. I can't keep all that at the top of my head. But it wouldn't be a great number of years. I mean, you know, talking about the lifespan of a single person, and partly they overlap, so.
Page 108.
What?
Page 108.
Page 108. Okay, there's your answer. Right there. Page 108. All right. Now, so that explains the altar. And Samuel says to Saul, don't worry about the donkeys. They've been found. But then look at what he says to him in verse number 20. He says, and as for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? I've been working on that sentence for years. And it still puzzles exactly what is. How do you take that last, that question that Samuel asked at the end of verse 20? I'm working on a theory, and I just want to see if anybody else. Is it not for you and for your father's house? What is he talking about? When you translate it literally, he says, and for whom is all the desire of Israel? That's what it literally says here. For whom is all the desire in Israel, or of Israel, literally is the way I would translate it. Is it not for you and for your father's household? What do you get out of that? Let me get some opinion, because I'm working on this connection with my book I'm writing. Doesn't have anything to do with this verse, but I'm using this verse as a support. Yes, Mark?
Could be a little bit of a prophecy here, whereas the desire of Israel, Israel wants a king, and Saul becomes a king later.
Okay. All right. Just sit on that for a minute. Is that what you were going to say, something, Dan? That's not the way it's usually interpreted. That's the way I see it. But that's not the way it's usually interpreted. You check your commentaries, and they say what Samuel is actually promising here is that Saul is going to have all the desirable things, material goods, that are going to be generated, and they'll be given to him and to his father's house because he's the king. He's the future king. That's the way the comment. I see it the way you see it. And it doesn't really make any difference in this verse, except there's a famous prophecy over in the book of Haggai that I've been working on that uses this same word, the desire of all nations. And I'm trying to gain some insight from this passage to help me with the other passage. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that the word desire here is singular, not plural. One would expect it to be plural if he's talking about, I would think, wealth or whatever. It's a minor point, not perhaps of great interest to you, but of enormous interest to me right now because I happen to be studying it in connection with something else. But at any rate, I'm pleased that some of you at least saw it the way I see it and not the way most of the commentators take it. And anyway. So Samuel is speaking to this fellow, Saul, and is trying to get him to start thinking in terms of the crown, of the kingdom, of reigning. And he sort of drops hints along the way, doesn't he? And this is one of them. And then when they go up to eat there at the meal, what does Samuel have done for Saul that again alerts him to the fact that he's someone very special? Special chunk of meat. Note the reaction of Saul. Verse 21. Am I not a Benjaminite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel? My family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Now, if you go back to where it identifies Kish back in verse 1 of chapter 9, I wonder if Saul is perhaps a little bit overly humble here. For it talks about Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjaminite, a mighty man of valor, or perhaps wealth, is the marginal reading. The word is ambiguous. Suggests to me that Kish was a leading citizen. I think Saul's being a little bit overly humble, maybe, here in chapter 9. Yes?
I've got the same comment. Notice you said the slowest speech you made, Stephen, in Acts 7, says, mighty.
Well, you weren't with us. Were you with us last quarter?
Yeah.
We talked about how he was probably exaggerating his lack of ability, too. Okay, Mark. I'll go back and change your grade. Yes. Well, I don't know. In the light of what it says in verse 1, it seems like to me that Saul is exaggerating his insignificance, if that's possible. Anyway, the next morning when Saul begins to leave, the servant is sent on ahead. Samuel anoints him with oil on the edge of the city, kisses him, gives him three signs. Three signs that what he's been telling him is going to come to pass. First was rather natural, not too much. Two men will meet him by Rachel's sepulcher and report to him that the donkeys have been found. Then he'll meet three men by the oak of Tabor who will come up and actually give him presents, which would be a little bit unusual out of clear blue sky. And then the third sign is very unusual. You'll meet a band of prophets coming down from a high place, and you will join them and begin to prophesy. And sure enough, all three of those signs came to pass. These were confirmatory signs, chapter 10, verse 7. And it shall be when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. This job isn't too big for you. God is with you. All right, so tell me about this band of prophets. We meet this band of prophets two times in the Scripture, chapter 10, chapter 19. It says they were prophesying. What does it mean in this context, according to what you read in the syllabus today, Mr. King? Who remembers a similar episode from last quarter in the book of Numbers, chapter 11?
The elders all started prophesying.
They all started prophesying. Now, we normally think of prophesying as being something akin to preaching, don't we? Guy gets up, he begins to preach, and perhaps make some predictions and that sort of thing. But here we have a group doing it all at once. Now, obviously, they're not all preaching at the same time, and they're not all predicting at the same time. But it mentions musical instruments, doesn't it? Like a Salvation Army band coming along. I'm not sure how to picture this, except to suggest that maybe this was something like rhythmic praise for the Lord. Over in the book of Chronicles, it talks about prophesying to God on the harp. How do you prophesy to God on the harp? So the only thing I can suggest is the word prophesy in the Scripture had a little broader meaning than what we normally give it. That it has to do with praising God. And apparently rather vigorous praising of the Lord, as we will see in chapter 19. What was the reaction of the people when Saul joined this band of prophets and began to prophesy with them, Mr. Ender? Is Saul also among the prophets? What do they mean by that? Does that mean that the people held this group of prophets in low esteem? No, I don't think necessarily. I don't think so. That some people interpret it that way. I'm inclined to think that they're just shocked that a timid fellow, and obviously Saul has some timidity about it, that a timid fellow like Saul, big, tall, gangly fellow that he was joining this group of prophets right in the thick of things. It's just totally foreign to his whole character. It would be as if, you know, somebody like Lobo back there would all of a sudden begin to scream and run around the classroom or something. It's just totally foreign to her character. We hardly know she's here. Are you here, Lobo? You're blushing. It's all right. Oh, you're kind of a quiet young lady. Now, when somebody does something totally out of... Oh, I don't know her well. It's different up in the apartment. Okay. Well, you can imagine if she were to do that, somebody would say, is Lobo also among the rowdies? Well, anyway, that was the reaction of the people. Now, Samuel makes some arrangements. Verse number 8, I want you to be sure to mark that, underline it. It's going to come up again in a lesson or two. But he says, you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do. I am convinced that more was said about that meeting than what we have here in verse 8. I think verse 8 is a very brief summary of what Samuel told Saul. Otherwise, it's hard to understand exactly what happens a little bit later on in the story. But mark this. We'll be coming back to examine it later. All right. Now, Samuel, in chapter 10, calls the congregation, the whole nation together, and he's already privately anointed Saul. What was the purpose of this meeting at Mizpah? Yes, Mr. Marsh. All right, and how did they go about, how did Samuel go about organizing this meeting at Mizpah to to prove that God had chosen Saul for Israel. Yeah. No, he did something rather unique. Yes.
He gathered the families together and drew lots.
All right.
He gotten it down to Benjamin. And
all right.
Again. And
each of the tribes, the tribe of Benjamin was selected, and then right on down the line. What does that remind you of that we studied in Joshua? Where'd they do the same thing? When they were trying to discover Achan's identity, the thief that stole there at Jericho. And so they're using that same process, and however you might imagine it, it's not described in detail. I imagine maybe you had the tribe's leaders march up and pick a piece of pottery out of a hat or something. And one of them was marked, this is it, something like that. I don't know exactly how they carried that, but it was very clear from this process that they went through that God was choosing for them Saul. But remember, they wanted a king like all the nations, and so God sometimes answers our prayer. Has it ever happened to you? God punished you by answering your prayer? Yeah, sometimes it happens, because sometimes we don't pray what we ought to have, we pray selfishly, so God punishes us by answering our prayer, sometimes. And he did on this occasion. So I don't think Saul was God's first choice. Now, this leads us to inquire as to why Saul was selected at all. What did he have going for him?
Tall.
He was tall. Now that is not unimportant. The earliest word that we know in the human language for king is the Sumerian word lugal. L-U-G-A-L. Lugal, which means literally big man. And if you go back and look at the ancient art of the Sumerians and the Akkadians, you will always see inevitably that when they depict the king, he's always seated and always five times bigger than anybody else in the picture. Now, is that just a quirk of their artwork? No. We know from their literature that the guys who were first selected to be kings were the tallest guys they could find. So Israel said, we want a king like all the nations. God says, all right. Then the height, obviously, is one of the qualifications. Here's a man who, from the shoulders up, was taller than any man in Israel. Now, I take that to mean that everybody else came up to his shoulders. But what else does it say about Saul that might commend him for leadership? Yes. He was handsome. Do you know in Bible days if you had any kind of physical defect or blemish, you couldn't serve as king? Witness the guy, for example, that was smitten with leprosy and had to spend the rest of his days out in the leper house while his son ruled the country. Witness the kings that we saw back in Joshua that had their thumbs and toes cut off. They were maimed. They were disqualified from serving as king. Okay, so that was part of it. You had to be good looking, handsome, and the appearance of Saul is legendary. Let me give you some references. His physical appearance is described in 1 Samuel 10:23. Okay, we might take a look at that one. That's right here in our text. It says, so they ran and took him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than all the people from the shoulders upward. We've mentioned that already. Then 1 Samuel 9:2, it said again, it emphasizes his height. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than all the people. Then in, where does it speak about his handsomeness? Did I miss it?
No.
There it is. I just didn't read earlier. He's a handsome man. There was not a more handsome man among all the sons of Israel. Okay. And later on in the poetry, he's referred to as the Gazelle of Israel. Now, in Bible days, the epitome of beauty was a deer. A gazelle is a deer type of beauty. And to compare a human being to a beautiful animal was the epitome of compliment. And Saul is called the Gazelle of Israel.
Would that mean that he was a good runner?
Well, I don't know about that. I think it's meant in terms of his appearance, but maybe so. What was the wisdom of making the first king from the tribe of Benjamin? Yeah. Why would that unite the country? Okay. Who were the two biggie tribes that were always fussing with each other? Ephraim and Judah. Where was Benjamin located?
Right between.
Right between. So I think it's a stroke of genius that a person from the smallest tribe, the two biggie tribes, then wouldn't. I doubt very seriously if the tribe of Ephraim would have accepted someone from Judah at this point. And I doubt very seriously if anybody in Judah would have accepted anybody from Ephraim as king. But by picking this guy from Benjamin right in between, you see, they got some degree of consensus about who their king would be. Also, I think there is evidence, now this may sound strange, but I think there is evidence that Saul was sincerely religious. I'm citing 1 Samuel 28:3, where he drove all the witches out of the country. I'm citing another case that we'll study tomorrow, where he would not allow his soldiers to eat blood from an animal that had not been properly killed, following the scruples of the laws of Moses. And then, of course, he's humble. And that's a good virtue quality for anybody who's going to assume a role of leadership. Our time is up for today, and tomorrow we will continue on into Saul's reign. And meanwhile, give some thought to those projects, and let's get something rolling on those. Glad to have our guest. Larry, would you introduce our guest to us back here?
Yeah, this is my brother-in-law, Tom Brisbane, and my sister, Denise.
Tom and Denise, glad to have you with us.